Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Thursday, and welcome to the Motor One Test Car Happy Hour, where myself, Brandon Turkus, Managing Editor of MotorOne.com, is joined by Mr. Brett T. Evans, Senior Editor, and Mr. Jeffrey Perez, also Senior Editor. We're going to be here with you for the next half hour, 45 minutes, maybe an hour if we get really chatty, talking about the cars that we've been driving over the past week, and we've got a little bit of everything here. We have the new Toyota Grand Highlander, the BMW Z4, the Honda Accord, and the Range Rover Sport. As always, you can chime in on whatever platform you're watching this on and leave your comments, questions, concerns. So let's dive into it, and we'll just run in reverse alphabetical order because I don't know what I want to say about the BMW Z4. So let's start with Mr. Perez in the grandest of Highlanders.
Yeah, I drove the Grand Highlander last week. I was very fortunate that Toyota wanted to host an event in Hawaii on the Big Island. So they flew me out there to drive this and to see the new Tacoma. And the Grand Highlander is interesting because they kind of did the same thing that, well, they did do the same thing that Jeep did with the Cherokee and Grand Cherokee, and even Bronco and Bronco Sport to an extent, where they just, they have this nameplate that they believe is very strong, and they've sold almost three and a half million examples of the Highlander since it, you know, arrived in the U.S. So by sales alone, it is pretty strong, but the name is kind of odd because this is a totally different vehicle than the regular Highlander. It is, it's bigger, it's more spacious, it's much nicer inside. The technology is totally new. The only thing that those two cars share is the 2.4 liter engine. And they're tuned totally differently depending on how you spec it. And the Highlander even has like a really powerful range topping hybrid, which I'll get into in a second. But Toyota really doesn't have, before this, they didn't really have a foothold in the sort of like the midsize three row space. I think the Highlander is a little too small, and the Sequoia is, you know, obviously truck based, so it's kind of different. But this goes up directly against the Kia Telluride, Hyundai Palisade, Honda Pilot, Traverse, you know, the one of the most popular, most successful categories anywhere. And I think that the Grand Highlander does a good job of sort of hitting the basics, even though it whiffs on a few things. I don't love the design. I think the design is really sort of, the proportions are all weird. I don't know if there's a good picture, Kyle, of like the side profile. Like, there's just so much uninterrupted metal sort of like on the back end and on the front end. The headlights and the taillights are really small. And then someone noted this on, was it Twitter, that the grill looks like a Lexus grill. Like, it's so big, that bottom grill. It just takes up so much real estate up there. So that's my big like miss with Grand Highlander. And then the base engine is a 2.4 naturally aspirated, only 265 horsepower. And I know that doesn't like that, that sounds like a good amount, but this SUV is really big and it weighs a lot. And you really feel it, like you really have to hammer the throttle to get this thing up to speed. And then once you take your foot off the accelerator, it just immediately slows down. It just feels so heavy with that base engine.
So just so we're clear, it's an all hybrid lineup, right? They're not making 265 horsepower from a naturally aspirated 2.4, are they?
It is. It's naturally aspirated.
It's a turbo 2.4.
Oh, sorry, turbo, but it's, yeah.
Okay,
it's not hybrid.
Yeah. But it's still pretty like lethargic compared to the other one, because you do get a standard hybrid, like a, I don't even know how to explain it, because the top one is not like a plug-in either. There's like a mid-range hybrid, and then there's a more powerful hybrid, which is the Hybrid Max model.
Hybrid Max is just Toyota speak for, you know, like a performance hybrid rather than an efficiency hybrid. Yeah. If it were a plug-in, Toyota would be calling it the Prime. So yeah.
So here's my immediate confusion from the powertrain lineup. This thing has three different powertrains in it. So two hybrids and a turbocharged four cylinder. Hyundai and Kia have one powertrain. Traverse has one powertrain. Mazda has one powertrain. I think really the only notable competitor to this car is the Explorer with three powertrains with three very distinct personalities. How does that shake up? Do these all feel like kind of different vehicles? Because you go from a hybrid Explorer to a 2.3 liter Explorer to a twin turbo Explorer ST, and they're very different personalities. Will anyone even care that there's more than one option here?
It's really dependent. I think I noted this in my review, but the base engine is definitely a little lethargic on kind of like hillier, mountainier roads. It definitely, you really need to bury your foot like in the pedal to get it going anywhere quickly. If you live somewhere flat, like I do in Florida, if you're just driving on the highway all the time, it probably won't bother you. Like it probably is just powerful enough. But the difference between the base non-hybrid engine and the hybrid max is like night and day. And I the hybrid max might actually be the best powertrain in this class. A lot of the, like you said, the V6s in the Kia and the Hyundai are great. Ford has a few great engines, but I really liked this hybrid max powertrain. It's kind of the same surprise I had when I drove RAV4 Prime, right? The immediate kick of torque from the electric motors, just the seamlessness of how the gas engine kicks in. It accelerates really quickly for such a big vehicle, and it maintains a lot of that speed without, you know, feeling like it doesn't power. And then you still get 27 mpg, which is like close to top of the class for such a powerful engine. So it definitely has like a split personality there. But it offers a lot of like the really good stuff too in terms of packaging, even out of the box. It starts at 43, which is a little pricier than what you get on Telluride and Explorer and Palisade and some of those alternatives, but it has a lot of really great stuff like the I don't remember what Toyota calls their fake leather, whatever it is, whatever their fake leather is, it's pretty good. All the trim is really solid and nice. Like there's not a lot of flimsy materials. Some of the trim was not great, but it's just a really solid three row. I don't know. It's hard to say because this segment is so tough. Like it's not an immediate. When someone asks like what three row should I buy, I always go Kia, Telluride, and Hyundai Palisade. Like you really can't go wrong with either of those. I think this is not an immediate recommendation for me, but it's sort of like the second tier of really good three rows, depending on what you want, like alongside Grand Cherokee L and Pilot. And it's really dependent on what the buyer wants, but I think it's got a lot of really good features.
The thing that is kind of compelling to me about the Grand Highlander is I know the base engine doesn't make as much power as the V6 competition, but it makes a lot more torque than the Palisade or Telluride do. My sister has a Palisade and she likes it a lot, but whenever they have it loaded down with kids and ski gear and stuff like that, it's kind of a dog getting up, you know, they go skiing a lot. So getting up to the mountains, it's kind of a dog climbing the hills. And so I kind of would be curious to know if the base Grand Highlander engine with the turbo and all the extra turbo torque, if it would be, you know, maybe not as thrilling around town, but better once it's actually loaded down when you're kind of comparing actual use cases.
Yeah, I think that's a great question too, Brett, because your family lives in, you know, they go skiing, they live near the mountains, right? Altitude is a factor in the driving they're doing, right? Yeah, so I mean, I'd be curious of that too, because I definitely understand that the sensation that the base engine might feel sluggish at sea level in everyday driving, but I'd be curious how it would, you know, how much more energetic it might feel relative to the competition when you're climbing or when you're at higher altitudes.
Yeah, that would be a good test. I mean, to me, it felt, and I've loaded up the Palisade before with, you know, a bunch of my buddies and luggage and stuff, and it definitely wasn't quick. Not that any of these are like really quick, but it sort of felt like the Palisade did when it was loaded up, if that makes any sense. And it was just me and one single drive partner in there. So it definitely needs a little bit more, in my opinion. But like I said, it's not like unbearably slow. And if you live, you know, somewhere flat, I think it'll be fine. So it's not like the slowest thing in the world.
I guess the thing that I struggle with is I feel this way about most of the vehicles in this class is I would rather just step up to a truck-based SUV and pay a little bit more for the amount of space and utility that you get with that. I mean, what's the tow rating on this? And is there really, you know, that much more space than a regular Highlander to make it worth the premium?
So towing is 5,000 pounds, which is not bad. I don't have a lot of the other figures offhand, but I know that's pretty decent.
There's also a ton more space than the regular Highlander. I mean, I think it's got 20 cubic feet of cargo room behind the third row, which is...
Yeah, well, that's...
I think it's even more than you get in the Sequoia, actually. I think that the Grand Highlander is larger in terms of cargo space.
It has the second most third row cargo space, or cargo space behind the third row, I should say. I think the Telluride is slightly better by like a cubic inch or something like that. The interior is really spacious. And to your point about comparing it to a truck-based sort of like a Sequoia or something like that, it actually drives really, really well. I was surprised at how, for as big as it feels when you're kind of accelerating with the base engine, it actually handles really well. The suspension is like nicely sorted out. It's not too soft. It's not too firm, but it's also not, it doesn't have a ton of body roll. So it's actually really nice to drive. I don't know. I think that there's definitely I should say this. The Sequoia does not have a flat load floor when you fold down all three rows for whatever reason. Toyota did that. This one does. You can fold all three rows totally flat and just slide, you know, all the cargo in there. So it does have a ton of cargo space.
Weirdly, it's because of the Sequoia's battery. It's because of the hybrid battery in the Sequoia.
That's right. Yeah.
It's weird because the Grand Highlander Hybrid Max has a huge battery as well, but you know, it's not a body on frame vehicle, so it's a little bit more easy to package.
Yeah. Actually, Seth had a good question. Grand Highlander or Grand Cherokee L? Oh man, if it's my money, I'm probably going Grand Cherokee L just because I like the styling and I think I like the just the overall feel of it a little bit more. But I think the Grand Highlander probably makes more sense for more people just based on how it's packaged. And the technology is probably just as good as Grand Highlander, if not maybe a little bit better. It has that new infotainment system, the newer Toyota infotainment system that I think we all really like. So that's a tough, I think honestly, those two might be the closest comparisons as far as, you know, if you don't want a Telluride or Palisade.
I'll tell you what, I mean, I'm having trouble imagining just how big this thing is, but the broader point that I wanted to make, because I don't find the Grand Cherokee L to be that sizable, even relative to a regular Highlander. But what I was going to say is, if we're talking about Grand Cherokee with the Pentastar V6, it's easy. I'll take a hybrid Toyota any day of the week. But if Jeep goes ahead and puts the Grand Wagoneers or the Wagoneers 3-liter twin turbo straight six in there, it's no question the Jeep is going to be head and shoulders above. The problem that you run into is that the interior quality between the bottom two trims and the top two trims is like, you know, night and day.
That was going to be my point, is the last time I was in a Grand Cherokee L, it was a limited. So, you know, not stripped, not a base model at all. And it just had the most hard plastic, natty interior. I mean, it was terrible. And I haven't driven the Grand Highlander, and so I can't say if it's any better. But, you know, I think I can see like a padded center console there for your knees. I think I can see some nice materials, you know. So it doesn't from the pictures, it doesn't look cheap, and that would be enough to sway me toward the Grand Highlander, maybe with the hybrid or the hybrid max powertrain.
I think that's the move, really. I don't see anyone needing a base XLE Grand Highlander without the hybrid engine. I think there are better choices if you're going that route. But I think if you want to get a really good, solid, like nice to drive SUV, like you said, really, really great materials, like surprisingly good, even for Toyota, and then the Hybrid Max engine, I think that's the way to go. And I'm looking at pricing really quick here because I forgot. So the one I tested, basically fully loaded hybrid max limited, was $59,460, which is a little bit more than like a loaded Telluride or Palisade, but you also get the hybrid max powertrain, which I would say is better. You get more to just as much third row space. Gary asked about the third row seating. It's fine. I wasn't like blown away by it. The entry is sort of talked about how easy it is to get into the third row by folding the captain's chairs. I didn't find it any easier than a lot of the other SUVs. It kind of has the same mechanism. Like, it's nothing special. So it's just fine. But
I'll tell you what, the third row thing real quick, it's always interesting, like, because we don't talk about it a lot, but the Nissan Pathfinder has a really innovative way of folding the moving the second row forward so you can access the third row. You can even do it with a child seat installed. None of us have kids, but I can see the value in not having to rip that out to the third row seat. And the Grand Cherokee L actually has a huge amount of third row space.
Yeah. That was my question, Jeff. When they're bragging about how easy it is to get in and out, did the whole thing tip forward so that, like, you know, it wasn't like the seat back pinching the seat bottom or?
Yeah, it tips forward. It's just not like super intuitive. You still have to reach up and grab a handle sort of on the top. There's not like a one button solution or anything. I didn't really find it very intuitive compared to, like Brandon said, Pathfinder or anything like that. But it's fine. Like, it works. And then you could also get the seven seat version, which you see here. It has a little center console right there between the two seats, but it's removable. So you can just slide it right out and walk through the center if you want to. The console thing is, it's nice to have, I think, but it's also kind of weird putting your drinks kind of on the floor. It's pretty low down. Like, it would feel odd to me to put my drink or something there in the center console on the floor and worry about somebody knocking it over, but it's a minor, you know, little thing.
I had a question and it totally, oh yeah, I was gonna point out Gary's comment, hybrid, better fuel or more power, depending on if you get the max or not. I was just going to point out that if you do get the max, you still get, I think it's like 27 miles per gallon city.
27, highway. Yeah.
Like, it's way, way better fuel economy than any of the V6 competitors. Nearly mm-hmm. as much as Seth, that is terrible advice. Nearly as much as like some of the turbo four, the hybrid competitors, and you still get 365 horse or something like that.
365. Yeah. And even if you get the base, even the base engine gets 33 combined, and then the hybrid gets the standard hybrid, not the hybrid max, gets 34 combined. So if efficiency maybe is like your number one thing, and you don't care about having a little bit less power, then those two are solid options too. But like you said, even the hybrid max at 27 MPG is like almost best in class.
There it is.
Sorry, I'm responding to multiple things. Yes, as Seth said, we do not support or recommend roadies of any kind. So please keep your booze at home. And speaking of booze, let's talk about something that drinks prodigiously, the Range Rover Sport that Brett has been driving.
Now, I wouldn't go that far because I was really surprised that it's rated at like, I think it's rated at 21 combined.
So first of all, were you in the PHEV or were you in the, no, so I drove this thing on the first drive and I don't even remember what they said was coming over here to the US. It's a very screwy powertrain lineup.
We get two powertrains currently. We get either the mild hybrid inline six or the BMW twin turbocharged V8 if you get the autobiography. And then you can also get that V8 in, you're about to be able to get it in like a 621 horse state of tune. This one had the turbo six. It had the P400, so 395 horsepower. You could also get it in the P360, I think, which gets 355 horsepower. This was kind of the middle tier P400 SE dynamic. So first of all, with regard to, you know, it doesn't actually drink that much fuel. It's a pretty efficient luxury SUV. I was flogging it real hard with Kyle in the front seat the other day, and we were like achieving a pretty solid 16 miles per gallon flogging, 20 or 21 on the highway. EPA rates it at 21 combined, 24 highway, like not bad at all for what you get. And it has just been a peach. It is just such a delightful, comfortable Really, really nice luxury SUV. I drove the Cayenne a couple of weeks ago and really liked it. It's a great, fantastic car. But as tested, this Range Rover Sport was $100,000 and a Cayenne comparably equipped is like 105, 110 with less power and less straight line speed. And if you want something that matches that this for straight line speed, you're paying like 120, 125. So I was just really impressed with pretty much everything that this truck did. I really liked it. I don't know. Like, it's just been nice to see it in my driveway. I've enjoyed looking at it from my kitchen window, and it looks great. Drives really well. I love it. I'm a big fan.
It's such a good design, but I hate this color on it. It just kind of like grays everything out.
No. you need to see it. And it's not, I will say, it's not phenomenal in this cloudy light. I wish we had maybe a little bit more varied light. It's beautiful. It like kind of has like a tiny little hint of blue in the sunshine. With those wheels, it's incredible. I love it. This is my perfect spec.
The screen is great. The screen is super cool. I love how they just curve it slightly to make it look a little bit more interesting.
So the one thing that kind of got me when I drove this thing in September of 2022, I walked into it thinking, well, it's a Range Rover Sport. It's the smaller version of the full size Range Rover. In terms of the actual footprint on the road and the weight, the two cars are almost identical. Yeah. This is very nearly the size of the Range Rover, but we were able to drive this and a full-size Range Rover back to back, and the difference in character between the two is, I mean, it's just wild in terms of like the immediacy of the steering on the Sport, the way that the body moves through corners. Did you notice any of that, Brett? Did it feel especially more agile or entertaining to drive?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely felt much. The Range Rover is an avowedly luxurious car, you know, like I think even if it weren't so heavy, I they would probably skew it more toward straight line stability and kind of like that cushy, wafty comfort. Whereas this definitely feels a lot more planted. You know, I'm not going to go so far as to say it is a sporty SUV, at least until we get like the, you know, the SV or the SVR versions. It's still 5,000 pounds and, you know, no rear axle steering and heavy for sure. But it felt just as enjoyable to drive as I would have expected, while also being incredibly comfortable. 23-inch wheels and it still rode so smooth over bad pavement. The issue, Brandon, with regard to its dynamics is I did drive the Cayenne a couple of weeks ago. And so I kind of came into it I wasn't expecting it to drive like the Cayenne, but I had that in the back of my mind as I was driving this thing fast. And, if you want a dynamic SUV, there's really every single version of the Cayenne, even the base engine, even the hybrid, they're all so, so athletic that, you know, I don't think a Range Rover could ever possibly touch the like kind of the nimble athletics of a Cayenne. So, you know, I kind of like was very content to dial it back and just enjoy the ride more so whenever I was in the Range Rover Sport, rather than kind of try and attack a corner.
So we're seeing the air suspension work now. Did you have a chance to take it off road at all?
No, I didn't even bother. This one is the dynamic. So it's got the body kit with the chin spoiler and the ground effects. And then it also didn't come with the optional low range. You can get a low range on these. It's a $360 option. I don't know why you wouldn't tick it just because it's a Range Rover.
This is really the suburban soccer mom spec.
This is definitely like urban cruiser spec more than anything. But so that's what I did with it. But I didn't even bother with the off-road bits. It seemed like a really risky thing to do with something like this. But that said, every single Range Rover, whether you get the low range transfer case or not, it comes with like wade sensing. So it turns off the parking sensors and it tells you how deep the water you're driving is. It's got a wading depth of like 2 feet and 9 inches, I think, like something ridiculous for
sounds right
for this car. You're like, there's no reason you'd ever be driving through water that deep in your $100,000 SUV. But yeah, so it's just got, you'll maybe see him in a minute here. It's just got tons of like cool off-road features that help you kind of monitor the vehicle and know what terrain you're driving over. Yeah, so that's definitely one thing that it has in its playbook that most of the other luxury SUVs don't, like the X5, the GLE. A lot of those have been decontented and their off-road packages have been removed. And of course, Range Rover's never going to do that with any of their cars. They're always going to kind of maintain that they can do some rugged stuff in a Range Rover.
So what do you guys think of the styling? I touched a nerve.
No, I love it. I just like, again, I backed it into my driveway a couple of hours ago. I went out and took some photos today. I backed it into my driveway and it just like was one of those cars. When you park it, it hunkers down automatically into that access height, which makes it as low as it possibly can go. And I parked it, locked the car, and just kind of like was unlocking my door and glanced over my shoulder at it. And I like stopped and turned and looked at it for a solid 30 seconds because it is just such an attractive vehicle. I can't believe that rear bumper is legal because it barely juts out at all, but it's gorgeous. It's so pretty. I love it.
Yeah, I love the design of this thing. But like I said, I don't know. Maybe it's better in pictures. The colors, like, it needs to be red or blue or something bright.
The red is excellent they have on
yeah.
this.
That, and like, then the wheels,
The
wheels, like, I've seen better wheel options on this. Like, this is a pretty basic spec, I think. But the design as a whole, I know Brett's going to be mad at me, but the design as a whole, I love it. It's awesome.
Oh man, no, this is perfect. They have a few other wheel options that you can get that are like, they've got like a really cool swirling star one, but it only comes in gloss black and I can't stand black wheels. I hate them. So if you could get them in silver, I'd be happy. But otherwise, this is pretty perfect. I do agree. Like any color is better than gray or white, but of the grays, this is a pretty good one.
A great one.
Ooh, bad pun. We got too much time left for puns like that. So let's. Brett hates black wheels. Yes, you see, we have it in writing and in video now.
I hate blackout packages. I hate black wheels. I hate gloss black exterior accents. I hate it all.
You know what? But I have this conversation all the time, like with my like non automotive friends. Can you blame automakers for doing it though? Because everyone buys it and it costs them pennies.
I know.
To produce, and they can charge like $1,000 for it.
It costs less than like matte aluminum. Like the Audi aluminum optic side view mirrors are like beautiful matte aluminum, and gloss black plastic is way less expensive for them.
Yeah,
and everyone wants it anyway. So if they can charge more and pay less to make it,
I can't blame the automakers for it. I can blame you, the car buyer. So please stop. Please stop. So talking about a car that also has a fair amount of gloss black, it's a returning guest, the Honda Accord Hybrid that I have been driving. I did not request this vehicle for a loan. This was lent to me by Honda to drive to the Indy 500 last weekend in Indianapolis. And I'm taking it to the Detroit Grand Prix this weekend. So a whole lot of racing. I've already put 700 miles on the thing driving from my house in just outside of Detroit to Indianapolis. I did a little bit of driving around Indy while I was there and then drove back. 700 miles, totally comfortable, has all the active safety stuff standard. And until I buried the throttle once I got back to across the Michigan border and started doing 85, I was getting about 44 miles for the gallon. It's a fantastic sedan. It's boring. It's not very fun. I know a lot of people miss the 2 liter, but man, this hybrid, it just has it all. It really has it all.
I got nothing against it.
What is the output on the hybrid?
It is, I want to say, I don't have it right in front of me right now because I wasn't planning it. Yeah, I was going to say it's 204 or 207 or something like that. 250 some odd pound feet of torque. It's much quieter than the CRV hybrid, which is great. It'd be a deal breaker if it weren't. I drove the Sport this time. The one that I reviewed was a Limited. I don't see any reason. The only reason I would buy the Limited is because it comes with heated seats. It kind of floors me that this is like a $34,000 car without heated seats. But it comes with all the active safety stuff standard. It has a lovely infotainment system. It is comfortable. It's spacious.
Did it have the leather seats, or did you have the sport cloth?
I had the sport cloth, which I actually liked a fair amount. Not as much as I like the leather, but I did like them. They seemed to wear well. It was comfortable. I mean, I'm not kidding. I did 300 miles in this thing on last Thursday. A week ago today, I did 100 miles while I was there, and then I did another 300 miles back on Monday, and it never really put a foot wrong. So I don't want to spend too much time on that because we have talked about that on the podcast, and there is a link to the you can read my full review of the Accord on the site. But I just want to touch on that because, you know, when you put 700 miles on a thing, you want to talk about it a bit.
Do we like the design?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't like any Honda designs nowadays. I just
see
they're generic. And bland.
I can't remember if I'm contradicting myself now even, but I like the design of this now that I see it more. I don't remember if I disliked it when it came out or not, but it was kind of weird. But I like it. I've seen a few, and I really like the proportions on this thing.
It does look great in this red. Like, the one that I have is the same color, and I dig it in red.
I like that Honda is pushing the base of the windshield back a little bit on both the Civic and the Accord. It makes them look a little more... they don't look quite as, like, frumpy in my mind. I wish the details were a little more exciting. You know, that front end is all Taurus Police Interceptor to me.
My argument in my review was it is a Peugeot 508 front end with an Audi A7 back end, but no charm, none of either car's charm. Like, none really of the, like, fun detailing.
I really like the rear end a lot.
I do like the rear end more.
I really like the taillights. I love that the Honda badge is small. I love that they didn't do, like, a big, massive... There's something about the rear end that looks like...
They could have done a word mark. They could have done, like... Because I think the Pilot has a word mark now.
Yeah,
exactly. They resisted the urge.
So much worse with this. And I appreciate that they kind of, like, restrained it a little bit. Like, it's maybe a little... To your point, right, Brandon, like, it's definitely, like, a little restrained and definitely a little boring. But I like that they haven't done... I like that they didn't go overboard with it. They kind of... I don't know. I think the next generation, the last Accord was overwrought. This one's too tame. The next one's just going to be perfect.
Honda really does kind of vacillate between, like, we're going to go crazy, and then, like, no, we need to calm down. We need to be a little bit more responsible. And they never really find that middle ground. But yeah, I mostly agree with what you're saying. Someone that's not going to agree with what I'm saying is Jeff Perez. And because we're going to move on to the BMW Z4, which is a car I really like. I'm sorry. I like it. The only complaint that I have is that the seats are the worst BMW seats I've ever experienced, short of the BMW X7. But I mean, I'm driving an M40i right now. It's pretty much the same spec of that Jeff drove and reviewed, I want to say back in April, I think now. Kyle, can we mute the audio? Because I've got the Rolling Stones playing on the radio during that. Which is, will get us copyrighted. it was Rolling Stones Live, man. It was good stuff. Sirius XM came through. So this is the Thunder Night Metallic 2023 Z4 M40i. Turbocharged, straight six, 3 liters, 382 horsepower thereabouts, and about 400 pound-feet, I want to say. I'm technically off today. I haven't really done a lot of prep for this. But no, I absolutely adore this car. I think it is the cure to the common Porsche. It's definitely better balanced between comfort and luxury and performance. Whereas I think the Porsche goes a little bit too wild or a little bit too focused on performance. But yeah, I adore it. So Jeff, lean in.
You said cure, like the Porsche, like the boxer's a disease. Like, I think that's a little mean, but...
This is the first time I've ever heard you suggest that a common Porsche is a bad thing, Brandon.
I mean, it's if we're talking about the flat four Boxster, then yes, it is a bad thing. No, it's just I like the balance of this vehicle more. I love the 718 in every form. I don't mean to joke about the flat four. I really do enjoy that car. I think it's a delight to drive. But I also live in Michigan. We have one twisty road in the entire state, and it's 50 miles from me. And we have really crummy pavement in this state, and this is just a better car for navigating that kind of world. It's simply more comfortable. The visibility is great, top up or top down. This one has gotten compliments everywhere I've went with it, everywhere that I've gone. And I don't know how much of that is color. The color is great. The color is really fantastic. It's a car that's very cool to be seen in, and it doesn't suck to drive. It's interesting because we think about BMW M cars and they tend to go a little bit overboard in terms of like their exuberance and their firmness and whatnot. And I really think the M40i or the M30i or whatever, like the middle ground, like not the full hardcore M cars. I think they strike the right balance between what we used to know and where BMW is at now in terms of its performance focus. And I think better than most, this one, you know, finds that balance.
I agree with you. Go ahead.
Nope.
Okay. I agree with you on the seats, Brandon. I think BMW has a hard time sort of like you can get the base seats and they're pretty not great, or you can get the most aggressive, craziest seats you could ever imagine, and you have to just live with those. Like, there's no middle ground for a lot of the stuff.
I had a really good thought about this while I was driving, and this is such a low volume car that I'm fairly confident that the basic seat frame and cushioning is the same for both versions of Z4. And the reality is that they built a seat that is easy to get in and out of, easier to get in and out of than a comparable Porsche seat. And that is a little bit less constricting as you're going down the road. And I think in terms of that, it's fine. I think the bottom cushion could be a little bit softer, and I personally would like more bolstering, but I think I understand what they were going for.
Yeah.
I'm going to go on record and say that I might be the only person in the world that doesn't actually really like the M40i powertrain very much. There's something about, like, I in the M240i and the M340i, especially, it feels really like there's no middle ground between, like, the eco mode and, like, the sporty mode with in terms of throttle response. I like the four-cylinder a lot more. I drove the four-cylinder Z4 a couple of years ago, and I haven't driven the six-cylinder, so I need to drive the six-cylinder and, like, compare and be the tiebreaker vote. But I actually really liked the way the four-cylinder behaved, and I like the way the four-cylinder behaves in, like, the 230i than the M240i. Just feels a little – the 40i's feel a little more they feel a little too sharp and a little too buzzy for me. There's something about them that just, like, it's hard to dole out power smoothly, whereas the 30i, it's less power, obviously, but it feels a little easier to kind of, like, pour on and control.
So Gary is chiming in asking about the proportions, especially the hood. I think that's a natural question on any roadster. This is classic short deck, long hood. I love the proportions. Aside from the 2 Series, I don't think there's any better proportion BMW on the road right now than the Z4. I love it. Yeah, I spent a lot of time on the profile shot there because I think it looks great. The little lip spoiler at the back, it's really great. I enjoy the design. I enjoy the way that the front or the side grille kind of is echoed on the back bumper. It's just a nice little touch. In general, though, I love the way this thing looks, even if it weren't in such a good color.
I remember when this car came out a few years ago, this generation, I think people were really hard on the looks. And I would say that I'm not, like, in love with the styling, but I think it looks good. I think the headlights are the problem with the larger, like, the overall aesthetic.
I can't get behind any BMW with stacked headlights. The Z4, the 2 Series, or the 2 Series Grand Coupe, any of those with the stacked headlights, I can't get behind it.
The problem is if you look at a, you know, 3 or 4 generations of 5 Series or 3 Series or X5 or even 7 Series, you can generally spot a common thread. And with the Z4 and the Z3 before it, I mean, there is no common thread. Aside from the basic form factor, it is like each one was penned by an entirely different automaker. The first generation Z4, the Chris Bangle car, I think is probably the best of the breed. Yes, Brett owns one, so he's biased. That's why I'm not calling on him. The second generation Z4 looked a little bit cartoonish with its, you know, the way the hood curved over and it had these kind of goofy headlights. This one splits the difference between those two, but it's a bit like what we were saying about Honda. Like, BMW can never really figure out how it wants to style this car. So it just kind of grabs onto whatever theme is common or dominant in its design language and runs with it. Whether that worked or not, I don't really know.
BMW is a prisoner of the kidney grill design. They do not want to keep the kidney grill, but they know they can't get rid of it because it's just so ingrained in their heritage. But they do everything. Look at the new i5. They do everything to try and like hide them, make them really big, make them really long. They're just doing so many variations of the grill, and I don't think most of them work. It's so weird, just the current era of BMW design to me.
I don't want to tweet my blogs because I know Seth Miersma is watching, but I just gave me a really good idea for a little fun thing that we could do. One thing I will say about this that after, so I was in the M2 last week. I'm now in this. Man, I hate iDrive 8 right now. I hate it. Cause this has the older generation of iDrive. It is just superior in every single way. It's just flat out better.
I don't know. iDrive 8 was good when it came out. I really liked it on the iX when it was brand new. I sort of disliked it, or sort of liked it less on the i7 when I drove it, because it feels like they have so many features on that car, in particular the i7, that it just like adds so many options. You can go to like the option screen on the i7 and just scroll and scroll and scroll, and there are so many things.
It's you can do. Every one of these little tiles, like there are all these little tiles, and you have to tap each individual one, and you can't reorder them quickly, like alphabetically. Yeah. Sorry, I've been sitting on this for like a week. you can't reorder them. Go ahead, Brett.
I feel like if you own the car, because you can reorder them manually,
yes,
right?
One at a time. But there are I am not joking. There are like 60 of them.
Yeah.
It might be an auto journalist problem. It might be like we're in a different car each week, and this is not a problem that the average owner would have. But if I'm the average buyer and I get in there and I'm confronted with that in the showroom, I'm like, what the hell is this supposed to be? I can't navigate this.
We talked about it with the i7 last week, or the 7 series last week a little bit, that like when you sit down with like your assigned BMW genius and they put everything in order for you before you drive away from the dealer, I think that's...
You shouldn't need a genius to buy a car. This is not an iPhone, it's a car.
No, that's the thing though. Every car is an iPhone now. Like there are 8 million different functions, and a lot of cars are a lot more like intuitive about it than the BMW is, for example. But you know, I feel like once you get the car set up how you want it, and once you get your grandson to do it for you, I think you're going to be fine. I don't think you're going to have nearly as many complaints as we do getting in and out of different cars every single day.
That is entirely possible. But in the moment, I'm going to enjoy the fact that this car has the old generation of iDrive, which I thought was pretty much perfect. Sure. I don't think I've used the touchscreen once. I've exclusively used the dial, which is just the superior system. Current iDrive reminds me of like the first like two or three generations when it was really bad. So
the dial, I mean, Mercedes and BMW getting rid of the dial was not a weird decision, because everyone's doing touchscreens, but it was a decision that I think a lot of people disliked, because it is so much better and more intuitive, in my opinion. I think Mazda still even like is reluctantly going to touchscreens because they know that they're...
Well, Mazda's infotainment is just straight up bad.
Well, I know you say that, but
I gotta make 6 inputs to change a radio station. I counted once.
Yeah, I definitely think that like the dial as a redundancy is nice, but having the touchscreen is clutch. The fact that you can't operate anything on a Mazda except CarPlay without using the dial drives me crazy. I like the redundancy.
Yeah, that's really weird.
I like the redundancy better than, you know, than the, like I like having the option, but yeah.
I'm just settling into my new state as a troglodyte. Give me BMWs from the past 6 or 7 years. They were just the infotainment was better.
We went and drove an original iDrive 5 Series a couple of weeks ago.
That had to be fun.
It was honestly, it was it is old enough and clunky enough now that it's transitioned over into charming. We're like, oh, this is cute. This is so funny the way that technology used to be. You know, it's kind of like using a like VCR or something like that. But yeah,
I mean, I'm gonna show my age, but I remember because I was working in the press fleets when BMW rolled out the generation of iDrive that had like the dedicated buttons for communications and nav and map and radio and all that stuff, so that you could have these quick access buttons. Basically, the version of iDrive that we know now, I think it was iDrive 4, I want to say, iDrive 3 or 4. And it's it was remarkable how big of a step forward that was at the time. Yeah. All right, so we are coming right up on 45 minutes, and I think that is going to call it for this week. We will be back next week for much, much more. You can check out MotorOne.com. You can check out InsideEVs.com. We'll have more cars next week. We might even have more people next week. Who knows? But for now, I'm Brandon Turkus. I want to thank Brett Evans and Jeff Perez for joining us. And we will see you next week. Have a very, very good and safe weekend.
Have a good day,
everybody.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.